pull up a chair. I want you to close your eyes for a second and imagine a sound. Or really, imagine the absence of one. You're a German soldier on the Eastern Front, winter of 1942, dug into a trench somewhere along a frozen river. It's the middle of the night, dead quiet, and then you hear it, not an engine, not a roar, just a soft swishing sound overhead, like somebody sweeping a broom across the sky. And by the time your brain figures out what that sound is, the bombs are already falling. This is Radio Hangar, I'm Tail Dragger, and this is The Hangar, and today we are going to talk about the women who made that sound. The Germans called them the Nachthexen, translated, that means the night witches. And I promise you by the end of this hour, you're going to understand exactly why. Now, before we climb into the cockpit, let me tell you today's show is brought to you by AviationSoul.com. Aviation challenge coins for every milestone in flight. First solo, private pilot, instrument rating, all the way up the ladder. If you've earned it, they've got a coin for it. Every coin tells a story. And friends, the story I'm about to tell you is exactly why we hold on to these things, why we mark the moments, why we remember. Check them out at AviationSoul.com. All right, let's set the scene properly. It's the summer of 1941. Germany has just launched Operation Barbarossa, the invasion of the Soviet Union. Millions of men pouring east, and the Soviet Union is bleeding. They are losing ground, losing men, losing airplanes by the thousands. They need pilots. They need anybody who can fly. Now here's where it gets interesting. There was a woman named Marina Raskova. And in the Soviet Union in those days, Marina Raskova was famous, a household name. She was a navigator and a pilot who'd set long-distance flying records before the war, the kind of aviator who got her picture in the papers. Think of her the way Americans thought about the record setters of that era. People knew her name. And young women all across the country were writing to her. Thousands of letters. Women who could already fly, a lot of them trained through the Soviet flying clubs, begging to be let into the fight. Because the answer they kept getting from the military was no, go home, roll bandages. This is men's work. Raskova took those letters straight to the top. And in October of 1941, she got permission to form three all-women air regiments. Pilots, navigators, mechanics, armorers. Every single job on that flight line, done by women that had never happened anywhere in the world. Not like this. One of those three regiments was the 588th Night Bomber Aviation Regiment. And that's our regiment. That's the one the Germans would come to fear in the dark. Now let me tell you what they had to fly, because this is the part that gets me every time. They flew the Polikarpov Pu-2, and I need you to understand what that airplane was. It was a biplane, two wings, one on top of the other, wire and struts in between. It was made of plywood and canvas open cockpits, two seats, one behind the other. It was designed in the 1920s as a trainer, a crop duster, the airplane you learned to fly in and then went off to fly something serious, top speed, maybe 70-80 knots if you were in a hurry, and the wind was helping. This was not a warplane. This was the airplane your instructor soloed you in. And the Soviets looked at that little wooden fabric trainer and said, that's our night bomber. Sounds like madness, doesn't it? Back when aviguiers was cheap and airspace was free, that's the airplane you'd take to a pancake breakfast. But stay with me, because that little biplane had some tricks that no fighter in the world could answer. Here's the first one. It was slow. I mean genuinely. Deliberately slow. And that turned out to be a superpower. The German fighters, the Messerschmitt 109, the Focke Wulf 190. Those were fast, sleek killing machines. But a fighter has a stall speed. There's a minimum speed below which the fighter's wing quits flying and drops out of the sky. And the Pu-2 could fly slower than the German fighter could fly and stay in the air. Think about that. A German pilot would come screaming in to make a gun pass, and the biplane would just throttle back and slow way down, and the fighter would blow right past, unable to slow down enough to hold his sights on her without falling out of the sky himself. Second trick, that plywood and canvas construction, on the early war radar and against the tracking they had. A wood airplane doesn't show up the way a metal one does. She was hard to find, and when the bullets did come, they'd punch clean through fabric without hitting anything that mattered. No big aluminum structure to shatter, just holes in the cloth you could patch with a needle and thread the next morning. And the third trick, the one that gave them their name. That's the good part, and we'll get there. But first I want you to climb into that open cockpit with me, because I want you to feel what these women actually did, night after night after night. It's below freezing, often way below. This is Russia and Ukraine and the Caucasus in winter, and you're sitting in an open cockpit with the wind screaming past you at 70 knots. No heated cabin, no canopy, frostbite was a constant enemy. Some of the women told stories later of the cold being so brutal their hands would freeze to the controls, of leaning out over the side to drop the bombs by hand and feeling the wind try to tear their fingers off. And here's a detail that still stops me cold. In the early days, they flew without parachutes, not because they were reckless, because they chose to carry more bombs instead. The airplane could only lift so much. Every pound of parachute was a pound of bomb they couldn't drop on the enemy. So they left the parachutes on the ground and carried the extra weight in ordnance. They flew combat missions over enemy lines with nothing between them and a burning death but the skill in their own two hands. No radios, most of the time. They navigated with a map, a compass, a stopwatch, and their eyes. Dead reckoning, the old way, the way that separates a real navigator from somebody who just follows a magenta line. Time and heading and a pencil in the dark. Over territory where getting it wrong meant you were now over an airfield full of people who wanted very badly to kill you. The airplane carried two small bombs under each lower wing. Later they'd rig it for more, but we're talking a couple hundred kilograms of bombs on a good night, on an airplane that had trouble carrying its own crew, so one trip wasn't enough, not close, and this is the thing I want you to really sit with. These women didn't fly one mission a night, they flew a mission, landed, and while they sat in the cockpit, the ground crews, also women, sprinted out in the dark and hung new bombs and topped off the fuel by hand, by flashlight, sometimes in 5 minutes flat, and then they took off again and again and again. On the worst and busiest nights, a single crew might fly 8, 10, a dozen sorties before dawn. Some accounts tell of 18 sorties in one night. 18 times over the target, 18 times through the searchlights and the flak. Let me put that in pilot terms so it lands. You know how you feel after a long cross-country, one good day of flying, you're wrung out, you land, you're ready for dinner and bed. These women did 8 or 10 or 18 combat sorties between dusk and dawn, in an open cockpit in the cold, getting shot at, and then they did it again the next night, and the next, for years. Now, here's where it gets interesting. Here's how they earned the name. The German flak gunners and searchlight crews figured out pretty quick that these little biplanes were coming. And a slow biplane caught in a searchlight is a dead biplane. The light finds you, the light holds you, and the anti-aircraft guns walk the fire right up the beam and tear you apart. That was the danger, being seen. So the Night Witches developed a technique, and it's the most beautiful, terrifying piece of airmanship I've ever heard of. They'd fly in toward the target up high. And as they got close, they would throttle the engine all the way back to idle, sometimes shut it down entirely, and they would glide. That noisy little engine goes quiet, and the only sound left is the wind whistling through the wires and struts of a biplane in a silent descent. That's the swishing broom sound. That's what the soldier in the trench heard, not an engine warning him. Just a soft whoosh out of the black sky, the sound of a witch's broom, and then the bombs. They'd glide in silent drop and firewall the throttle and claw back up into the dark before the searchlights could ever find the source of the sound. No engine noise to track, no exhaust glow to aim at, just a ghost, and they often flew in threes. Two airplanes would come in first and deliberately draw the searchlights and the flak, jinking and weaving, lighting themselves up as bait, pulling all that fire onto themselves. And while every gun on the ground was busy chasing those two, the third airplane, engine cut, silent as death, would glide down through the gap and put her bombs right on the target. Then they'd rotate. Next pass, a different airplane played bait. They took turns being the target so their sisters could kill. That, friends, is discipline. That is airmanship and courage of a kind that I don't have words big enough for. The German soldiers started saying these had to be witches. No man could fly like that. Coming out of the dark with no sound, gone before you could shoot. So they called them Nachtthexen, the Night Witches. And here's the part I love. The women found out the Germans were calling them witches, and they were proud of it. They embraced it. You want to call us witches? Good, be afraid. There's a story that some of them rubbed their navigation pencils into their skin as makeup, that they picked flowers and pressed them in their logbooks, that they danced and sang between missions and then climbed into those freezing cockpits and flew into the guns. Young women, a lot of them barely out of their teens, living two lives, girls on the ground and witches in the sky. Let me tell you about one of them, Nadezhda Popova, Nadia, they called her. She joined up young, driven partly by the war landing right on her own family, her own home overrun, her brother killed. She flew, by the accounts that come down to us, hundreds of combat missions. There's a knight that stayed with her the rest of her life. She got shot down, made it down alive, and while she was retreating on the ground in a column of wounded soldiers and refugees, she met a wounded fighter pilot in that same column. His name was Simeon. Years later, after the war, after they'd both survived, they married. Two pilots who met in the wreckage of the worst days of that war and spent the rest of their lives together. Nadia Popova lived a long life. She passed in 2013, well into her 90s, and right up near the end, she'd say she still couldn't quite believe it herself, that she and those girls had done what they did in those little airplanes. Now the cost. I won't dress it up, because they wouldn't want me to. Women died. They died burning in the air with no parachute. They died when the searchlights found them and held them. They died in weather, in ice, in mechanical failure over the wrong side of the line. This regiment flew for something like 3 years, right up until the end of the war in Europe, and they flew on the order of 20,000 or more combat sorties in total. Some tellings put it higher, over 20,000, some over 23,000. Thousands upon thousands of bombs dropped one wood and canvas trip at a time. And for all that, the 588th earned the highest honors the Soviet Union could give. The regiment was made a Guards unit, an honorific reserved for the best. The 588th became the 46th Guards Night Bomber Regiment, and more than 20 of these women were named Hero of the Soviet Union, the very top decoration, the equivalent of our Medal of Honor. More than 20 of them. From one regiment of women that the army had originally told to go home and roll bandages. They never lost their identity as a women's regiment. Pilots, navigators, mechanics, armorers, commanders, all the way through. Women who'd learned to fly in dusty little flying clubs before the war, who volunteered, who buried their friends, who patched the bullet holes in the fabric with needle and thread by lantern light, and flew again the next night. So why does this matter to us, sitting here in a warm hangar, decades on with our heated cabins and our moving maps and our parachutes and our forecasts? I'll tell you what I take from it. Every time I hear somebody say a certain kind of person can't fly, doesn't belong up there, isn't cut out for it, I think about a plywood biplane gliding silent through a searchlight beam with a 19-year-old girl at the stick and her navigator dropping bombs by hand over the side into a freezing wind. The airplane doesn't care who's flying it. The air doesn't check your papers. It only cares whether you can do the job. And these women could do the job better than almost anyone who ever lived. And there's a piece of pure airmanship in here too. Think about that silent glide. No engine, no radio, no instruments to speak of. Just a stick and a stopwatch and a picture in your head of exactly where you are and exactly where the ground is coming up in the dark. That is the oldest, purest kind of flying there is. That is the thing under all the avionics we've bolted on since. Feel the airplane. Know where you are. Trust your hands. Those girls flew on nothing but that, and they flew into the teeth of it, night after night, and a whole army learned to be afraid of the sound of the wind. My thanks to the historical record of the 46th Guards and the 588th, to the wartime accounts and the memoirs the airwomen themselves left behind, and to the interviews Nadia Popova gave in her final years so the rest of us would remember. You can find where we keep our stories over at radiohangar.com. Next time the wind whistles through the wires on short final and you throttle back to idle for that quiet glide down to the numbers, listen to it. That soft sweeping sound. And think about who else once flew on that sound and what they flew it into. This is Taildragger. Keep the shiny side up and don't you ever let anybody tell you the sky isn't yours.